Black Doctor. Hello and welcome back to Black Doctor's podcast. I am Dr. Stephen Bradley, your host. I am an anesthesiologist, critical care medicine physician, and medical ethicist. And my goal every week is to bring you inspiring stories of underrepresented and medicine minority physicians. This week, we're going to jump back into the conversation we started last week with Dr. Alicia Peterson. She is an anesthesiologist specialized in pediatric pain medicine. We continue on with her story. We talk about some of her experiences in academic medicine. I think there's lessons to be learned for people at all stages in their journey about what they can expect, what they will tolerate as they progress into this this field of medicine. Thanks for tuning in. Next week, join us for another episode. I'm going to focus on some medical ethics related topics and some current events and kind of how they intersect with our practice as physicians. Now we'll rejoin last week's episode already in progress.
Area. I will say to your point about being a Black woman throughout all of this, add on to that for me, I was pregnant. So I met my husband when I was doing that NIH research thing. We married as I graduated medical school, got married during that time. And then my first year of residency, third year, and then my first year of pain fellowship, I was pregnant.
I had three kids.
Yeah. Three kids, 7, 9, and 11. And I was pregnant each time. So talk about being an oddball, right? I'm like in this majority white male class, Black woman and pregnant. Mm. And there was a couple other Black women in my class. But for me, when I see someone else Black, I kind of want to shoot eyes at them and be like, you see this, or this is real, or just having that moment of solidarity that you're not crazy and you're seeing this and this is really happening. But I didn't have that in my class. The person that the other folks in there, they had their own agenda, right? They wanted to be chief. They wanted to be smiles and I got you. And it was a very different perception. So I felt very alone in my class.
And clinically, what we're talking about is when you're pregnant, as an anesthesiologist, we do cases with radiation and fluoroscopy. Mm-hmm. And in your pain fellowship, you're doing fluoro case. So how did you get that around that?
So that I shouldn't be in the ortho room or an IR and that kind of thing, vascular rooms, because, I'd be on the schedule and they would have to do a last minute swap. For when I was on pain fellowship, I just double leaded. So they have a specific lid for the belly, and then I put another lid on top of that. But it was tough. I mean, I had all kind of comments. I'll never forget one of the orthopedic surgeons. She's a woman. And I was in a bone cement room. They put me in a bone cement room with a methyl methacrylate. That's what they use to make the bone cement. And it's toxic. And you're not supposed to, especially if you have a developing like fetus in you, you're not supposed to be breathing that stuff in.
And it smells.
And actually it was the circulating nurses that said, we're not mixing this until she leaves the room. So they had to scramble to find somebody to step in. But the response of the orthopedic surgeon was, well, I had a bone cement baby. He turned out fine.
Oh, Lord.
And I'm like, oh, my gosh, no, you didn't. So because you were willing to expose your child, I'm supposed to expose mine. Oh, okay. Yeah. So it's funny that the solidarity that you get comes from places you least expect. Because the circulating nurse, that was a guy.
Oh, wow.
He was like, no.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
One of my favorite things now being out of training and in previous institutions where I'm running the OR, ironically, in anesthesia, your colleagues will probably know you're pregnant before your spouse is sometimes. But going out of my way to know, okay, this person can't be in that room. This person needs pump breaks. Don't tell me what you got to do. Just tell me you need to get out and I'm going to get some support. And just being able to provide that level of support and care to my colleagues is something I've really enjoyed.
No, that's, and that means the world. It really does. Because after I had the baby and I was pumping, so for all my kids, I pumped until they were 10 months old. And it was a really big challenge to do that because half the time you can't even get out for your lunch break. So how the hell am I going to get out for a pump break? Are you kidding me? And the fact that it's called a break is a joke in and of itself. But thankfully, since when I was in training, I happened to be on rotations that I could slip away to the mother baby suite, and they had the industrial grade hospital pumps. So I was able to pump in half the time quickly by just escaping away to those suites. So I was very grateful for that. I had that for my first and second child. And then for the third one, by the time he was born, I was a first year faculty member. And it's funny because it wasn't until I was a first year faculty that I really had issues with actually getting breaks. Oh. Because at the institution that I worked at, it was in the South, very white male dominated, very authoritative. And when I expressed at the very beginning that, hey, I'm going to need a break, and that break wasn't coming, the question that was posed to me was, can you hold it? I cannot believe the nerve. I said, if a horse kicked you in your chest, could you hold it? Could you provide care for a patient when you are hurting that badly?
It's like that.
If you don't get somebody in this room.
Oh, no.
Because that's how it feels. When you're that engorged, it is painful. One of the attendings that I worked with she just said, screw it. And she brought her pump materials with her everywhere. And when she didn't get a break, she just busted it out right there in the OR. And at the time, they didn't have those nice silent pumps they have now. You can hear it go. And the surgeon was like, what's that noise? And she was like, oh, I'm pumping. And she dared anyone to say anything, because if you're not going to relieve her, I mean, this is her legal right. Right? Yeah. You're supposed to allow for this kind of break. But anyway, well, it was during a maintenance phase, so no patients were harmed.
Thank you to you and her and your colleagues that have progressively broken down doors and kind of recreated the will and are making spaces for people that are coming behind you.
I mean, yeah, just by existing, right? Because you can't tuck us all in a dark corner or under a rug for too long. I mean, you can't use a bathroom as a pump space. It's not an adequate pump space, right? So yeah, we have to be vocal and we have to express that what's okay and what's not okay. So that was the extra layer of challenge I had during my training and all of that.
Yeah, for the timeline, you finished anesthesia residency and then you did straight to pain fellowship and then straight to peds fellowship? Or what was the order?
Oh, I did peds anesthesia fellowship first. Mm. So I went to WashU St. Louis for residency and I stayed on at St. Louis Children's for peds anesthesia. Yeah. Okay. And then for pain, I was looking at pediatric pain programs. And there wasn't that many. There still isn't that many in the country. And I ended up going to Boston Children's. I mean, it was just a fabulous experience. It's 6 months where it's peds and then 6 months adults. And I rotated 3 months at Brigham Women's and 3 months at Beth Israel. So you have to do some adults in order to get board certified in pain. And now that's the rationale behind
that. And what is your current practice like?
Yes. Oh, okay. So you are catching me right at a point where I'm in the middle of a shift and a transition. After fellowship, I did academic medicine from 2016 all the way to 2023. So I worked at one children's hospital for a couple of years and then spent the last almost 5 years at the children's hospital I just left here in DC. And I must say that when I first started working in academics, there's a couple of things here. So guys, I want you to pay attention. If you're in residency, seriously pay attention to the life of your attending, honestly, because I didn't do that. I didn't kind of reconcile the fact that here it is at 2 a.m. with this trauma and he's up with me. Right? Yeah. And if that's a life that I want for myself, to sleep at the hospital overnight and not being able to be with your family and all the things, I just assumed for some reason that magically when I became an attending, things were going to be different for me. Like, it just didn't make sense. And when I was an attending the first few years, I'm like, no, in-house call is not going to work for me. It's just not. And so because I did have the pain training, I was able to leverage that and just do inpatient pain as my call.
Okay.
But I realized, too, I didn't like the hierarchy. So in academics, you walk into it thinking that, okay, I'm doing academics because I want to train the future. I want to innovate. I want to make medicine better. And I want to serve patients at the highest level of care. You come in with so much enthusiasm, so many ideas, so many ways in which we can work more efficiently. And yet what happens is they look at you and say, wait a minute. You just got here. I've been here for 20 years. You're trying to say that you're going to do it better than me? Are you trying to say that what I've been doing is wrong and I've been here for 10, 20 years? People get offended and then people get intimidated by you. Like, oh, who do you think you are? And it's like, hello, I thought we were all in this together to make patient care the best it can be. And it's like, no, people got egos.
And you came from three different institutions with different perspectives. You've been here for 20 years.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And I would argue for anybody who is coming in and somebody tries to come at you with the whole, I've been here for 20 years, trying to pull rank on you. Remember, have they really grown in that 20 years or are they living the same year 20 times? I bet you they're living the same year 20 times. So don't be intimidated. There's no rank here, right? I mean, unfortunately, what tends to happen is people get indoctrinated. People get wrapped up in egos and politics, and patient care becomes in the backdrop. It kind of fades in the backdrop. And that's what I kept running up against in academics is people's egos being hurt. And it's like, I thought we were patient advocates, right? If I'm seeing something that's not right, why wouldn't I say something? Yeah. At one of the hospitals, I was at, I'll never forget this. They say not all skin folk is kin folk. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you're going to come across those. And it's hard to come across folks that look like us in anesthesiology because we're just like, we're concentrated in a few areas in the country. But this person was higher up in her position. So she had the ranking and it was somebody who otherwise I would have taken the advice. But the advice to me was talking, document everything and just stop saying anything. And then the question becomes, well, document to what end? What am I documenting for what? I'm documenting for me? Like, that doesn't make sense. And out of that, I just blew up, right? Like, I ended up talking more. I'm not going to be silenced. I sent emails out. Now I have a podcast. It's like, no, you're trying to minimize the issue, right? But I'm going to make it large.
Hide your light under a bushel.
Exactly. I just couldn't believe that was the advice. So yeah, it did not do that. And I ended up leaving organizations because I said, you know what? Maybe it's just this place. Maybe it's just my first job out of training. The first pancake never turns out right. Right? Let me try this again somewhere else. And from day one, I knew that something wasn't right. Like I knew that this wasn't going to be a good fit. And that it wasn't so much, it was just the feel of that whole organization. The fact that anytime you have to make any suggestion, it has to go through a committee. And the committee only meets once a month. And they already met this month. So maybe it'll be on the agenda for next month. But it might not be because they have so many other topics that were discussed before yours. So to make any shift is incredibly challenging. And then the whole pecking order. For me, I have the patient in front of me. If a patient has needs, we're going to meet the needs. I don't care if it's not your job.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Like, you know, as a physician, we absorb so much when we can't do it all. And we have to bring team members together to make the effort happen. But when you're around people and when you're in a culture where it's, I have to talk to my supervisor about that. Or, and it's like, I, even though I directed the clinic, the pain clinic where I previously was employed, I didn't have any hiring or firing power. So it was like, I had the title, I could bark, but I had no bite at all. So it was like, here I am being blamed for problems that I don't even have the authority to fully solve. It was a rock and a hard place.
Oh my God.
So ultimately, I ended up, I wish I could say that I got the courage and put my foot down and said, I'm not taking this anymore, I'm leaving. But what ended up really happening was they dangled the carrot of promotion in front of me. I said, ooh, I want a promotion. I applied. It takes a year to apply. And in the midst of all of that, my health started to, I was under a tremendous amount of stress. I wasn't getting the help I needed for the very complex patients I was serving. And I was walking to work and I couldn't breathe. Like I was taking three steps and I had to like catch my breath. I'm like, this is so weird. Like I walk a mile and a half to work every day and this day, I can only take three steps at a time. Now, here's the irony of it. I was walking to work really early because I had to teach trainees that morning. I had to do like a little didactic for them before starting my pain clinic day. And here I was like not really able to breathe. So I slowly made it to work. And then I said, you know what? I'll just go pick up an albuterol pump from the Pyxis and try that. And it didn't work. So here I am, dysmic, delivering this didactic. Like, thankfully, I have it set up where the trainees are doing most of the work. So I'm like chiming in every once in a while if the conversation goes off track. But yeah, I was like acutely dysmic. And I ended up calling a friend. And I was like, look, I tried this albuterol. Like, she's an ER doc. She was like, you sound awful. You need to go to the ER. And I was like, I don't want to go to the ER. Like, we never want to go to the ER.
Never, ever.
And I couldn't do it, though. Like, at the time, people were still wearing their N95s. We're still wearing N95s to speak to patients and things. And the moment I put that N95 on my face, I could not breathe. It was like I was suffocated.
Oh, gosh.
That was so scary. I was like, I mean, it was the scariest thing ever. So fast forward, I end up in the ER. They take a chest x-ray. I had bilateral pleural effusions. I was like, where did that come from?
Oh,
what the tarnation? And I ended up getting diagnosed with like this autoimmune thing. And I went from like only taking a prenatal vitamin just because I liked the way it made my skin feel to now like being home, sent home with like steroids and like Celcept and all these crazy things. And that was the moment where I was like, nope, my body. People are asking me, oh, do you have a family history? Do you have this? I was like, no, I am reacting to this toxicity, folks. I cannot go back to this workplace. That is what my body is responding to.
Wow.
The universe said enough. This is crazy. So the health crisis was really an act. I find it to be an incredible act of grace because it forced me to do something that I just did not have the courage to do due to my brainwashing, due to every mentor I've had, everybody has been in academics. And I never just thought of an option outside of that. It just so happens that when I started the second organization and I knew that wasn't quite the right fit, I started to listen to entrepreneurial podcasts.
Okay.
And I came across Dr. Una's podcast, Entre MD. She was the first physician I heard where she has her own practice. And she's like, others can do it too. And no matter where you are, you can be your own agent. Like you don't have to be brainwashed into doing things one particular way. If you don't like something, if you can't get it done where you are, you can build your own thing. You could do something else somewhere else. But at the time, that was just such a paradigm shift because I'm thinking that this is the only thing I can do. And that's how they want you to think.
Right,
they don't want you to think you got options. As medicine gets increasingly more corporatized and we're spending less and less time with our patients and we're having to generate those RVUs. But yeah, so when the whole health thing happened, I put in my letter of resignation right then and there. I had to give 3 months notice and I did. And it hasn't even been a year since I've left that place. And I'm already off all my medicines. Like, that's how real that was. I'm off everything. And for those pleural effusions, I had to get tapped. I had to get a needle put in that pleural space and drained. I had liters sitting in my chest, 1.5 liters each side. And I couldn't get them done at the same time because thorax, all that kind of risk. So I had to stay in the hospital. They tapped once, stayed in the hospital, had tapped the other time. And then you have to stay where you are for 2 weeks. You can't fly anywhere because of, again, the whole pleural effusion or pneumothorax kind of thing.
Yeah.
So now fast forward. All while I'm working, I always had in my heart, I want to do a TEDx talk. I want to do a TEDx. And so I went through, I got coaching. I ended up being able to do the talk. Now here's the thing. The talk was May of 2023. The health crisis stuff happened in March 2023. And the pleural effusions, because I was still at the organization, everything, they were reaccumulating. So I would have to get the right side tapped and then like eventually I'd get the left side tapped. Like it was a wild thing. And mind you, each time, I mean, I have to stay grounded. I can't fly anywhere. So here we are now. So March, April, May. May, I'm feeling short of breath again, and I'm like, oh, crap. Like, I need to get tapped, but if I do, then I can't do my TEDx. And I'm like, oh, I'm doing my TEDx, okay? And it's called, I ended up doing it. It's called How Chronic Pain is Falling in Love. And I am, now that I listen to it again, I am dysmic as heck. Like, I'm just like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe that I am doing this talk. And when I came back to DC after doing it, I had to fly out to California to do that talk. And when I flew back in, ended up draining like over a liter.
Oh my gosh.
But I'm like, this is crazy. But I was like, no, I refuse to like not do it. I'm like, how often do you get the opportunity? So yeah, that's sort of the context for when I did that talk was just like, oof. Oh my gosh, like I'm dysmic and I did it anyway. And thankfully, should your listeners decide to, I hope they listen to it. But many people said that they couldn't tell that I was like acutely, like dysmic from the effusions. They thought it was just me being nervous. So I'm like, okay, well, that's very kind.
Gosh, we're getting short on time. So I got to start to wrap up. I do want to talk about the podcast because you host the Sivo Sisters podcast. So tell us, when did you start it? And then what is your goal with the show?
Yes. Okay. Thank you for bringing that up. So when I was in residency, I felt incredibly alone. All the crap that was happening to me throughout residency, I had to deal with that by myself. I felt like, I was crying on a regular basis just with not feeling seen, not really feeling like I could speak up because I didn't have anybody really to connect with. Many of my attendings, bless their hearts, being a woman, being pregnant, and they just couldn't relate, right? So I always had in my heart that I wanted to build something, make something so that others who were in my situation could still feel connected, could still feel like you are seen, you are heard. There are other people who have been down this road. It's nothing personal. And here's how we could get through that process together, right? Like, because we want everyone to make it through their training. And even after you make it through your training, we want you to realize there's a network of faculty and attendings out there who are still pushing through and still got issues. And how can we work through that together? So I had that always in the back of my mind, but things didn't really kick off until I worked with the Society of Pediatric Anesthesia with two faculty members. We did a pipeline program, a pipeline program for Howard medical students because they don't have an anesthesiology like residency. The anesthesia faculty that are there, they're private practice. So they're not, I mean, they're there to make money teaching. They're not there to teach. So a lot of the Howard medical students, if they wanted anesthesia exposure, they were like cold emailing different faculty members in the DC area saying, hey, I share with you? Hey, can I get this experience? And it's like, man, that doesn't make any sense. There's so many programs here. You should never have to feel like you have to do that. So with a grant from the Society of Pediatric Anesthesia, we created sort of this program in partnership with Children's National and George Washington, that would allow Howard medical students an easier way. If you want anesthesia exposure, you can get it here. You can get it on the children's side. There's options on the GW side. And really, we wanted the other programs, Georgetown, Washington Hospital Center, to all feed into sort of having a DC consortium. And then one, as we were putting this program together, a lot of the students had the same questions about applying and the interview process and the hidden curriculum that you're sort of smacked in the face against that you really aren't aware of, things with professionalism and decorum and ways to behave. So I'm just like, man, if you guys have these questions, other people are going to have these questions. So instead of me answering these questions a million times, why not create this platform by which I can then refer you to this episode where we talk about this? Or, oh, is that a problem for you? Guess what? You're going to make it through because I spoke with an attending who went through that same thing. Here's her story, right?
Yeah.
Direct you to that episode. And that's how that grew and was born. And so, as you mentioned, SIVO is what we use a lot. Sevoflurane, SIVO is short for that. And then the sisters part, it was really to denote community. Obviously, we've had more than just women on the podcast. You were on there. We've got men there. And really, it's a podcast for minoritized individuals, those who felt othered, those who felt like outsiders, because the space of anesthesia has been just so white male dominated for so long that there are so many implicit sort of cultural things woven into that very much exclude us. And they're not even, you know, people aren't even aware of it.
It's fantastic.
So that was what the reason for the podcast. It comes out every week on a Monday, and the episodes are short, so they're designed to be consumed in the duration of an anesthesia break, which is often like 20 minutes or less. So that is the impetus behind that. You can listen to that wherever you know, you listen to podcasts. And so, yeah, it's been great hosting that and providing a space for us to tell our stories. And specifically within anesthesiology, we're different people. We're different. And I think that it helps that difference that we have as anesthesiologists is a way that we can connect in this podcast. Because so many of us live in our heads, very cerebral. We suffer from analysis paralysis oftentimes when it comes to some things. We like having our plans A, B, C, and D. And I think that in some ways certainly helps us in anesthesia, but in other ways, in other aspects of life, it can sometimes interfere with us taking leaps that we have to take.
Perfect.
Well,
we'll definitely put some links in the show notes. Definitely check out the podcast. Yeah. I've listened. Excellent episodes, great pace. And like she mentioned, it's short and you can consume that very quickly. Dr. Peterson, thank you so much for joining us on the show. As we wrap up and close out, what is kind of new or on the horizon for you? Any new programs or projects that you would want to leave with us?
Absolutely. So with the SIVO Sisters podcast, again, please listen, enjoy, consume, share. Also came out with a newsletter for the podcast. And we also have gotten, so we put out some teaser clips to really get people to be able to engage even before episodes come out. Also, I used to be on the admissions committee at GW and have, obviously I serve a lot of medical students and even undergraduates. So many people have concerns about, oh, I want to do medicine, but am I up to snuff? Do I have what it takes? A lot of imposter syndrome interfering. And it's crazy because when I see these students, it's like, you are so freaking brilliant. You don't even know it, right? Of course you're going to do well in medicine. Of course medicine will accept you. So what has come out of that is that I'm in the process of creating a digital course. A course uniquely targeted for those who have applied to medical school, have not gotten in, but they still have a fire in their hearts to want to serve as a physician. And then also for those who are switching careers and they may, again, still have this imposter syndrome, still think that, well, I don't know if I have what it takes because I didn't go straight through from undergraduate. This is a course that is designed to attack those pain points and get you accepted. And with all the experience I've had with working with students and being on an admissions committee, I think I'm definitely well suited to help guide folks in that journey to go into medicine. So with all that being said, I want to speak to those to whom that resonates, and I'll provide you with a Calendly link so we can do a one-on-one specifically about what has been those pain points and problems to ensure that this course meets your needs. So I will provide a Calendly link to you as well for folks to click on and
awesome. We'll make sure it gets in the show notes. I've been doing better with filling out the show notes. Dr. Peterson, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been fantastic hearing your story and your practice model.
Oh, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure having me. It's been a pleasure being on this podcast, and I love what you're doing. I love the Black Doctors podcast. I mean, just yes, all around. I will continue to amplify your work, and I thank you for contributing to mine.
Awesome. Thank you so much. We're here because representation matters.